You're listening to The County Writes, The County Reads, the Christmas Gift Guide Edition. I'm Lynn Pickering, and joining me now with suggestions for books for the gardener in the family is Colette McKinnon of the Prince Edward County Master Gardeners. Hello again, Colette.
Hello.
Now, you have four books you say would make great gifts for any gardener. What's first on your list?
Okay, the first one is called A Garden for the Rusty Patched Bumblebee, Creating Habitat for Native Pollinators, and its focus is Ontario and the Great Lakes. It's that edition, and it's a 2022 edition.
And what is so great about this book, and I have to tell you that I did interview Lorraine Johnson in June, so I do know what's great about it. So tell me what's in it.
Okay, so I'll tell you just quickly again, a little background for each book. I'll tell you a little background of the authors and then what it's about. And I do have a little piece from each book to read so that it might pique your interest. Okay.
Terrific. Yes. Okay.
Okay, so for this one, we have Lorraine Johnson and Sheila Kohler. So Lorraine lives in Toronto and she's been researching and writing about environmental issues for 3 decades. And Sheila Kohler is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University in Toronto. So, as you know, unfortunately, we are losing the rich diversity of plants and animals in our world. So this book focuses on bees. Canada has 860 bee species.
Amazing, and, isn't it?
Yeah, and 350 plus bees are in southern Ontario, which is also amazing.
Yeah.
Most of us think of the little yellow and black honeybee, but it's a little more rich than that. It's called the Rusty Patch Bumblebee because this is the first native species in Canada that has been designated endangered. And the authors, of course, make a plea for us as gardeners to help reverse this trend. And what it talks about again is our native bees are dependent on native plants for their survival. And there's a specificity of the relationship between plants and insects. So they don't just go to any plant. And that's why we need to inform ourselves a little bit better. So along with information about native bees, it also gives guidance on how to start a garden for pollinators. And they sample gardens from a balcony garden to a residential garden. So it's good for all of us.
Now, you wanted to read a bit from
it? I do. What it says here. So native bees are some of the most misunderstood creatures around. Popular misconceptions are that they all make honey, they're all black and yellow, and they all sting, and they all live in hives. But the majority of Ontario's native bees don't live in hives. They're solitary. They are not black and yellow. They're a variety of colors. And they do not sting. None of them make honey.
And that's Colette reading from A Garden for the Rusty Patch Bumblebee. What's next on your list?
You'll find a common theme going through these books, but this one is called Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. And it's by Douglas Tallamy. And he is a professor and chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and his research goal is to better understand the many ways in which insects interact with plants and how such interactions determine the diversity of animal communities. So his book was published in 2020, and you know, we hear so often about loss of diversity and loss of the environment just becoming impoverished. So it shows here a place where we can make a difference, as does the first book. As just as gardeners, you can turn your yard into part of a conservation corridor that provides wildlife habitat. So it's a place for hope, really. He has some wonderful and very interesting information in this book. And then at the end, he's got some tips of what we can do, like shrink our lawn, remove invasive species, plant keystone genera, network with our neighbors and encourage them to change their garden a little bit. And of course, don't spray or fertilize. But he explains why everything is necessary, which is interesting. So I can read a little bit from that book if you like.
Sure.
So plant defenses are very effective at deterring most insects because they don't want to be eaten. So I'm going to give you the example he gives of the milkweed. It uses various forms of toxic cardiac glycosides to protect its tissues. And very few insects can eat plants containing cardiac glycosides. But over the ages, monarchs have developed the enzymes that can make cardiac glycosides less toxic. And they also have a physiological mechanism for storing these distasteful compounds in their wings and blood, rendering their own bodies unpalatable to predators. And of course, their coloring warns predators. So they're orange and black, which serves as a universal warning signal to would-be predators. Don't eat me, I taste bad. And in addition to these, milkweeds also defend their tissue with a milky latex sap that gels on exposure to air. So if an insect attempts to eat the milkweed leaves, it soon finds its mouth parts glued permanently shut by the sticky sap. So who's going to eat that? Monarchs, however, have found a simple but amazing way to defeat this defense. They block the flow of sap to milkweed leaves. So when they first walk onto a milkweed leaf, they move to the tip of a leaf and start to eat a leaf. And then if any latex sap starts to ooze from the wound, caterpillar stops eating, turns around, crawls two-thirds of the way back up the leaf where it chews entirely through the large midrib. This simple act severs the main latex canals that move the sap through the smaller leaf veins, and then they can continue to eat the leaf because they've severed that sap from flowing. I mean, that's just incredible.
Well, that is fascinating. And yeah. And the part about the coloring of the monarch butterfly, really fascinating. I'm happy to say that we do have milkweed on our property. Yeah. So I want to make sure that it stays there. So
And this book is full of information like this, which makes your jaw drop, really.
Yeah, for sure. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And that book is called Nature's Best Hope.
Yes, by Ptolemy.
All right. And next.
And the next one is called Plant Partners, and it's a science-based companion planting strategies for vegetables. Many gardeners may have heard that carrots love tomatoes, plant them together and they grow well, but many books don't really explain why. So this gives a context to understand the relationships. It approaches the garden as an ecosystem with many different complex layers of plants and fungi and animals, which are all connected in a massive web of life. So whatever you do in the garden is not just one plant, boom, it's connected. And the aim is to use these partnerships to improve the overall ecosystem of the garden. So the first chapter gives a broad approach. So it talks about fungal associations, resource competition, chemical messaging, plant diversity and nutrient absorption, and factors that influence how well, these are all factors that influence how well plants grow alongside each other. And the next chapters then each take a common gardening problem and look at appropriate partnerships to overcome it. One chapter, for example, is about weed management and another is about pest management. And again, I have a piece to read.
Good, good.
Okay, I don't know if you've heard about allopathy, but if you have a walnut tree, you may know that not many plants like to grow around it. And that is because allelopathy is the ability of one plant to produce and release chemicals that inhibit the growth of other plants. So essentially, it's a form of chemical competition. It's known as allelochemicals. These substances can be found in any part of a plant, including the leaves, stem, flowers, roots, and even the fruits. They can also be found in the soil beneath and around an allelopathic plant. These chemicals affect surrounding plants in many ways, and because different plant species have different sensitivities to particular allelochemicals, some plants might show no signs of negative impacts when growing near allelopathic plants, while other species may wilt, drop their leaves, or even die. And these chemicals can persist in the soil too, sometimes long after the plant that produced them has died. But I'm going to give you a place where it's a beneficial to us gardeners. So in farm and garden environments, the power of allelopathy is used to limit weed growth. So winter ryegrass has some 16 different chemicals that prevent weed seed germination, but do not harm transplants of peppers, tomatoes, eggplants, and other vegetable crops that are grown in rye residue. So there is an example. She also talks about, unfortunately, the garlic mustard, which is a weed, and that secretes chemicals into the soil. And even after you've removed the weed, it stays there for a very long time. So it's a complex and intricate world we live in.
Another fascinating book, and we should say this is by Jessica Walliser.
Yes.
And she has a website called savvygardening.com that you could go to. But I like this description of her. Jessica lives in gardens northwest of Pittsburgh with her husband and son, 6 chickens, 2 cats, 2 hermit crabs, and billions of very good bugs.
There you go.
Now that's Plant Partners, science-based companion planting strategies for the vegetable garden. And
yeah. And
talking about vegetable gardens, so Colette, there were reports in the spring of 2020 that there was a spike in seed sales and interest in growing particularly vegetable gardens because of the pandemic. And I just wondered if the master gardeners have noticed more interest here in the county in the past few years.
I'm fairly new in the county, so I can't give you a history, but I would say, yes, there is more interest, and it's because of people's greater understanding of the importance of seed collection and local seeds in growing and successful growing of healthy vegetables and any plant, really, for that matter.
Well, speaking of seeds, that leads nicely into your next book.
It does. Okay, this one isn't so new, but it's a fantastic book, so I had to sneak it in. So it's called Growing Trees from Seed, A Practical Guide to Growing Native Trees, Vines, and Shrubs. So it's a hardcover written in 2008 by Henry Koch, and he was one of the most influential employees in the history of the University of the Guelph Arboretum. And there's one endorsement of this book that I read that might spark your interest, but it was by Luke Miller of Better Homes and Gardens. And he said, I get a lot of gardening books at work, but very few of them get to come home with me. And Growing Trees from Seed is one of them. His aim, it's again, you'll see a theme running through, is to inspire the gathering and growing of seeds to help restore and sustain the precious diversity of our natural heritage.
Growing trees from seeds, that's going to take a long time.
Right? Yes.
So you're growing really for the next generation.
Exactly. And some of us have only a small space, but there are so many places where trees might be planted. You could start it and then give it to a place that's trying to promote tree planting. Or it's also very interesting to do as a project with a grandchild to start a tree and maybe plant one tree for each grandchild if you have space. Yes, it's therefore, it is a long-term project.
Yeah.
But just as it's important to have local seeds to grow your vegetables and fruit, it's also, you'll have a lot more success with a tree that has been grown in your area and has evolved in your area with planting and growing it. It will be more robust and more adapted to the environment it's in.
So would that book tell you which trees would be best to grow in different areas?
Yes, it's a wonderful book. He gives you expert guidance on, collecting and germinating and transplanting seeds and their expected growth rate. But he does talk about the best environments in which they grow. And part of it is related to your own observation. So when you go for a walk and you see a tree in a specific environment growing well and it's native and there's seeds, you can try and replicate that environment where you want to plant it, or you're in the same area, so it's likely going to be similar.
Yeah.
In answer to your question, but it does have beautiful, clear, dis- illustrations and descriptions, because as you say, you need to know which trees, which are the native ones, and which ones do you want to grow. And it's easy to understand. And it's, again, another fascinating read. And I've got an interesting thing which links into your question, you know, what grows well in areas. We have a common saying that native plants are better adapted to growing in our climate than non-native plants, but that's not really accurate, because whether a plant thrives or not depends on our ability to match it to its ecological needs. And if you think there are many non-native plants that are much better adapted to some indigenous plants to growing in our region, just think of the buckthorn. I don't know if you know it. It's like it grows really well all over the place. Yeah. And these non-native plants are adapted to growing in a wide range of disturbed soils that result from human settlement. So that's, I think, the biggest difference, and that what makes this very complex, because our native trees have grown in undisturbed sites and we live in very disturbed sites. So nurturing, growing, and fostering native trees is a complex process, and this book helps us through that. But there's one really interesting thing that I found here in the book. So the truth about earthworms. Studies of earthworms reveal that none are native to the glaciated regions of North America. That affects our forests. So when they've invaded natural forests, they diminish the leaf litter and increase the rate at which forest soils dry up. So our native forests are used to these big piles of leaves that sit there. We like earthworms because they help with decomposition, but in a forest, a native forest, it's best left alone without earthworms.
Well, this has been fascinating, Colette. Really, these books are wonderful because you have a variety, but all sort of based on the same idea.
Biodiversity.
Yeah, yeah.
We have such a rich, rich plant and insect community. And it's not a maybe a buffalo or an elephant, but it may be a tiny bug. We just need to become more aware of them and look for them and learn about them. That it's an opportunity for us all.
Well, thanks very much. These are great suggestions.
Okay, thank you.
I've been speaking to Master Gardener Colette McKinnon. You'll find more great suggestions on the website, pecmastergardeners.ca, under the tab Books We Love. And for the books Colette recommended today, check 99.3 County FM's Facebook page at the end of the show. Coming up next, Books for Birders. Stay with 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county.